Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Ambassador Joseph Wilson. Ambassador Wilson is, of course, the ambassador who was sent to Niger by the Bush administrations to investigate by the CIA at the behest of the vice president, who investigate claims that were based upon forged documents that Saddam Hussein was trying to buy uranium from Niger. And when Ambassador Wilson wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times after the president's State of the Union, where he claimed that made this claim, Ambassador Wilson went public and said, look, they sent me over there to investigate these claims, and I told them that they were completely bogus. So I have no idea how they got in the president's speech in retaliation for telling the truth. Rather than punish Ambassador Wilson, the Bush White House outed his wife, a CIA operative who was involved in interdicting weapons of mass destruction and fissile material from the former Soviet Union. That whole network was destroyed by this White House that, of course, claims that its number one priority is to prevent the world's most dangerous weapons getting into the hands of the world's most dangerous dictators. So we'll be talking to Ambassador Wilson, who will be testifying this week. Congressman Conyers is holding a hearing in Washington on Thursday. And, of course, today in the London Times, the Sunday Times in London, an adjunct to the Downing Street memo was leaked and published. And this is a briefing paper that was associated with the same briefing. It indicates that in April of 2002, when Tony Blair visited Crawford Ranch, visited with President Bush. President Bush outlined his intentions to attack Iraq and remove Saddam Hussein. And this briefing memo also says that that the British and the Americans were going to use the United Nations to justify war, which contradicts both Bush and Blair's claims, which were repeated this week at the press conference in Washington, that they turned to the UN in order to avoid having to go to war. So we'll be talking with Ambassador Wilson in a moment. Then we'll talk with Gore Vidal. We'll have an extensive talk with Gore Vidal, and that should be very, very fascinating because he's the country's leading novelists and historians, as well as a social critic and a political activist. And we'll be talking about a number of things, including the last elections and the sense that something is rotten in Ohio. Let's now go to a discussion with Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who served in the State Department from 1976 to 1998. He was an ambassador, U.S. ambassador, posts throughout Africa under Republican and Democratic presidents. He was the acting ambassador in Baghdad when Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990. And he was the last American official to meet with Saddam Hussein. In February of 2002, he went to Niger to investigate reports that Iraq had attempted to buy uranium there. I'm speaking with Ambassador Joseph Wilson, the author of The Politics of Truth, which is now in paperback, the subtitle of which is Inside the Lies That Put the White House on Trial and Betrayed My Wife's CIA Identity. And Ambassador Wilson, I understand you're testifying on Thursday before a House inquiry that that Congressman Conyers is presiding over about the Downing Street memo. So it seems that on many fronts there's an effort on the part of a lot of people to force the press, to force the White House to come clean about how they got this country into this war.
I think that's a good way of putting it. The American press has been really, I think, derelict in reporting on what is an important memorandum. The administration has attempted to say it's not authoritative, but at the end of the day, this is a memorandum of conversation that took place between the chief of British intelligence and the British prime minister. And in that memorandum, the head of British intelligence tells the prime minister that the U.S. administration has fixed the facts to match the policy. That's pretty explosive stuff. And it is, as I say, a most senior conversation. And it should have been reported on. Now, since the press has not done this job, there have been over 250,000 people who signed a letter at the request of Congressman Conyers asking for an investigation to be opened up into this. Also, the memorandum itself, I am told, is one of the most requested pieces of information on the Internet. So there have been a lot of hits going to sites that actually contain the text of that memorandum.
And the memorandum, by the way, speaks for itself. I mean, it is extremely clear and in a very kind of cold, analytical language, almost like a fly on the wall. So there's nobody's ever disputed the authenticity of this memorandum. It would be the equivalent of an Oval Office conversation, wouldn't it?
That's correct. That's correct. It's the equivalent of a meeting in the Oval Office or any other a chief of state or chief of government office of a briefing, which is extraordinarily authoritative. What the prime minister was told was what the British head of intelligence had learned from his American counterparts in meetings in Washington.
And again, do you have any sense of why it has had so little traction, even though this leak that came about two or three days before the British elections is considered to have done tremendous damage to Tony Blair. Even though he was re-elected, he lost about a quarter of his seats. So it already got a lot of political traction in England and around the world. Do you have any explanation for why it has taken so much of the bloggers' energies? And, for example, they put up $1,000 to get a White House reporter to ask the question, and finally the British Reuters reporter did ask the question to both Tony Blair and George W. Bush.
So, I think it's an indictment of the state of investigative journalism in the United States that they're not looking into this. I believe that they are simply not doing their job. You contrast their willingness to accept whatever the administration says with the efforts of Watergate 30-some years ago, and of course it's suddenly come back on the front pages of the American press because of Mr. Felt exposing himself as Deep Throat. But the contrast between investigative journalism that took place during the Nixon administration when there were efforts to do things that may have been extra legal, and the lack of effort this time, and it's appalling. I think that it is a reflection of the nature of the press these days. I think it's a function of the extent to which they've been intimidated, a function of the extent to which the media has become subsumed into larger conglomerates that may have different and sometimes conflicting business agendas. And I think also, as has been said, it's important to understand that Washington is a company town, and everybody works for the man. And for journalists who, as one journalist told me, live in houses with swimming pools and drive BMWs and have two kids in private schools, are not prepared to jeopardize that security.
Well, of course, that's the same rationale, I think, the underlying rationale for why the White House punished, instead of punishing you for telling the truth in your op-ed piece, we're coming up on the anniversary of, which you wrote in the New York Times, saying, I'm the guy they sent to Africa to look into the Niger uranium deal. There was nothing there, I'm surprised, that got into the president's State of the Union address, rather than go after you because you were a favorite of Bush Senior's and an ambassador, a bipartisan professional. They went after your wife. And I take it, as much as one can understand the motives of those who were responsible for the leak to Novak, it was to basically intimidate the intelligence professionals who knew the truth about what this government was up to. And just, if I may, referring back to Watergate, Ambassador Wilson, but Watergate, by comparison to it looks as if George Bush is responsible for, is totally picayune. I mean, it's about a break into the Democratic headquarters, and of course, the lying part was what got him into trouble. But Nixon didn't do anything along on the scale of misleading a country into war—a war that is a gaping wound and done terrible damage to the United States throughout the world, and for which there is no exit strategy, and for which about 1,700 soldiers have died, and about 30,000 have been wounded.
And nobody knows how many Iraqis have been killed and wounded and displaced as a consequence of this war. But you're absolutely right. Watergate was, somebody famously said, a third-rate burglary. This, we're talking about issues of war and peace and whether the Congress of the United States was misled in the run-up to the use of force authorization debate, and whether the American public was misled about the motives and the thinking and the timing of the decision-making on an issue so important. There is no more decision. There's no decision more serious than the decision to send American soldiers off to kill and to die in the name of the American people. And we in a democracy, I believe, deserve to know how the hell this happened.
Well, it's extraordinary, though, that there, as again, there's not more focus. If Watergate set the sort of investigative journalistic standard, I mean, it seems that the smoking gun here has been wagged in our face. I mean, if you get the minutes from a meeting in July of 2002, the head of British intelligence just returning from meetings in Washington, basically laying out the mindset of the administration that they want to go to war. Then we find out subsequently that the documentation that they used to go to war, curveballs, information, which was used by Colin Powell in his presentation to the UN, and the famous Niger documents, which are the basis upon which the CIA, at the behest, I believe, of the vice president, sent you to Niger to investigate. Now there's indications that they were forged. This is a huge story. I mean, if a government manufactured its own bogus evidence for its own bogus war, to me that is it's not a smoking gun. It's Big Bertha on fire, you know.
Well, I certainly think that it's worthy of further investigation. It cannot be sort of laughed off, as the administration has tried to do, as something that has been discredited, or as the president's spokesman said, well, all this information was laid out in the past, and as the president himself has said, we had a vote on this, and the president, the population reelected me.
That was the accountability moment that he referred to.
That's right, the accountability moment.
Well, but the public is slowly becoming aware. I mean, the polls indicate that they're starting to, 57% majority now think that going to Iraq was a mistake.
Right.
It's I guess it's a question of how slow the worm turns here.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And clearly, their communications operation is phenomenal in its ability to stifle dissent and in its ability to spin stories in such a way that you're either completely confused or you just don't understand what's going on.
But
and half the population at the time of the election still believed that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, or the weapons of mass destruction had been found. But, you know, there's the old saying, I think it was Lincoln, who said you could fool all of the people some of the time and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. And in a democracy, this should come out. The fact that it's taking so long to come out would suggest a fair amount of complicity on the part of everybody, whether intentional or not. And it's safe to say that in the run-up to the war on Iraq, we were all complicit in this decision. Nobody asked the truly hard questions. Experts in the region were driven from the public square by these politics of character assassination and intimidation. The intelligence community was intimidated. The compromise of my wife's identity was very clearly a shot across the bow that if you did to the administration what I did, challenge them on the accuracy of the facts they were using, they would do to you what they had done, and your family, what they had done to me and my family. And the impact is chilling. It's very clear.
But contrast the effectiveness with how the press has been managed and how the Democratic opposition in this country was intimidated. I mean, the Democrats said don't be unilateral, and then 2 weeks before the midterm elections, Bush said, okay, I won't be unilateral. We'll have a vote, and it became a test of patriotism. And very few people, except one of the senators in the know, Senator Graham from the Intelligence Committee, voted against the war authorization. It turns out that the evidence that they were provided with in the NIE was very slanted and manipulated. But contrast that with the actual performance of this government in terms of its stewardship of American foreign policy. There's no question that what they have done is unbelievable and continuing incompetence. 2 weeks ago, I interviewed one of the senior State Department people who was in charge of the reconstruction effort, David Phillips. And it's breathtaking when you hear the story of how much effort went into preparing for the victory in Iraq, which was a foregone conclusion, and how that was orphaned by Rumsfeld for no particular reason except hubris, as far as we can tell, and how they've the conduct of this war, you know, people who were liberated now are trying to kill us wholesale. There doesn't seem to be any way out of it. I don't understand why we're not speaking not just truth to power, but just speaking the truth. It is so obviously a manifest disaster.
Well, certainly my assessment of all of this has long been that this was deleterious to our own national security interests, and that we ran the very real risk of having our global leadership severely impacted and damaged as a consequence of these sorts of actions. And I think I regret to say I believe that assessment has been borne out by the facts on the ground. Indeed, if you think about this in the context of the war on terrorism, which is what the president would like you to think of it in, you cannot but conclude that one of the consequences of our war with Iraq has been the growth of hatred of the United States throughout the world, and that hatred will translate into more people who are prepared to kill and to die in order to avenge what's happened in Iraq on the United States.
But if you lie to the people about the very basis of the justification for what is an optional war, a war that was not forced upon this country, that was taken as an option, which is in itself a new thing. If the evidence that you use turns out to be fraudulent or forged or both, it reminds one of that term in the law about the poison fruit from, say, an illegal search and seizure. It seems to me that what at the deepest level this country is going through is the poison fruit of dishonesty in the most fundamental way. We didn't have a national debate. Our opposition didn't engage in the national debate. The people were kept in the dark. And it is so clear that this action in Iraq is the result of the poisonous fruit. I mean, it's almost a moral thing, you know, that it's like original sin. Perhaps this is my opinion that's coming out here. Am I editorializing here too much, Ambassador Wilson?
But, well, I suppose we can put it in biblical terms, but I think that obviously my views on this are rather strong, and they're based on my experience there of 2.5 years. It has nothing to do with whether Saddam was a good man or a bad man. It has everything to do with how you enhance your own national security and don't weaken your national security. And everything that they have done, in addition to being potentially in violation of any series of international laws, has weakened us, I think, in the eyes of the world, and detracted from our ability to lead globally. Leadership, by definition, requires followership, and it's hard to see a lot of followers behind us as we're sitting out there in Iraq.
Well, but you're one of the few people that knew about Iraq. I mean, that's the extraordinary thing. Before the war, I talked to a few people who knew about Iraq and spoke Arabic and spent time in the region. They all predicted a quick victory followed by a slow defeat, and it's not as if the history is not clear from the British experience. And, I mean, it's... It that's the part of it that's also extraordinary, how little, how sort of cavalier the whole thing was. I mean...
Well, if you take the time, and your listeners take the time now to go back and take a look at the Project for the New American Century, which is essentially the blueprint for the neoconservatives and their view of how one conducts foreign policy, I think a lot of people will agree with me that rather than being a reasoned analysis and policy prescription, it is instead a set of ideological assertions. And I think that's what we have here. We had the triumph in policy circles of ideology over reality.
So this sort of right-wing romanticism has basically left us in a situation where George W. Bush's mistake has become all of our problem and the world's problem.
I think that's correct.
And one would like a little justice here for him to be held to account. I mean, everybody in that administration that's responsible for this disaster has been promoted. Even the analysts who gave us the bogus information about the aluminum tubes, apparently, they were, Condoleezza Rice has been elevated. She failed on two fundamental issues. One was the WMD, and two was 9/11. So where is the accountability?
So long as the Democratic Party is prepared to accommodate the administration, in other words, so long as they're prepared to pursue an approach to governance based on going along by getting along, this administration will push the envelope. So long as they understand and believe that nobody will stand up and fight toe-to-toe with them, they will do what any schoolyard bully does. They will continue to push, and they will continue to bully. So at some point, the Democratic leadership and indeed the people and the press are going to have to stand up and ask the hard question and begin to call this administration to account. This meeting next week, being chaired by Congressman Conyers, who has been vigilant, really, in going after the government and demanding accountability, is a good first step. I certainly hope that more Congress people, more of our political leadership, will stand up and say enough's enough. Certainly, I think the atmosphere for doing so is propitious. You've cited the poll numbers, and I think that it's a reflection of an America that is very, very ill at ease with what we've gotten into. The argument that I keep making has been that we failed ourselves in not having this debate before the war in Iraq. And we certainly failed, I think, the rest of the world, and we failed our own global leadership in allowing this to go forward without a full debate before. That said, the fact that we didn't have the debate before doesn't mean that we shouldn't have the debate now.
Well, just in closing, Ambassador Wilson, the investigation into who outed your wife is the only Achilles heel in 4 years of the first Bush term, and it's held on over to the second. And I've looked into this matter. You know, we're talking earlier about the phony evidence, the forged and fraudulent evidence that led to this war. There is, I believe, an FBI investigation that was prompted by Senator Rockefeller and the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, but it's being pushed one way by Senator Rockefeller and then Senator Roberts, the Republican chair on the other side, who's always carried water for the White House, is thwarting it. I mentioned it on my radio show recently in an interview with Vince Canestrero. He brought it up, that the fact that the Niger documents were forged here in the United States, not by Italian intelligence, as previously reported. Do you have any sense of when this smoking gun is going to explode?
Well, there's clearly three things that are outstanding. One is the denouement of the case of who leaked Valerie's name. Mm-hmm. That, I think, really depends on when the Supreme Court makes the decision to hear or not to hear the appeal brought forward by Judy Miller and Matt Cooper, the two journalists who have been challenged to reveal the sources of some stories that they were looking into, or in the case of Matt Cooper, actually wrote. That could happen any time, or the Supreme Court could decide to hold indecision until their next session in the fall. Notwithstanding what they decide, I think the special counsel is still working diligently to bring a case. I don't think that he would have allowed this to go to the Supreme Court unless he was serious about bringing indictments. With respect to the forgeries, there's still an ongoing FBI investigation. I don't know what the status of that is, but certainly a little bit of pressure on the FBI to produce a report and produce an outcome would be perhaps helpful. And third, of course, is the mandated report that the Senate is to produce on the political manipulation of intelligence. And that's the one that Senator Roberts is stonewalling. And, of course, as a Republican senator, he chairs the committee, and he is able to do so because he has a majority in both the committee, and there's a majority of Republicans in the Senate. And I don't know when or if that will ever see the light of day. Certainly there is no interest amongst the Republicans to embarrass the administration by pointing out that perhaps they did politicize the intelligence.
Well, but how about forged intelligence? I mean, how do you pressure the FBI to...
Well, in the case of the forgeries, it's not at all clear to me that it's definitive where these forgeries took place or who mm-hmm. Or who did them. What is clear is that there are a lot of stories out there, and it would be helpful for everybody to know whether or not one of the things that got us into this war was documents forged for the purpose of deceiving the American leadership and the American public.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles.
Oh, it's a great pleasure.
And for your new paperback version of The Politics of Truth, Inside the Lies That Put the White House on Trial and Betrayed My Wife's CIA Identity by Ambassador Joseph Wilson. I thank you very much for joining us in Los
Angeles. Thanks
very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Ambassador Joseph Wilson. I'm now speaking with Gore Vidal, who's an acclaimed playwright, novelist, and historian. And you have the in the current, on Common Dreams, on the web, an article you wrote, Something's Rotten in Ohio. I'm reminded, actually, of your book, 1876, which talks about Rutherford Hayes. He was from Ohio, too, wasn't he?
Indeed he was.
Yes, there's a statue of him at Kenyon College. I guess that was his alma mater.
Well, I'd rather see a statue of Paul Newman, who graduated from
there. Indeed, indeed. Paul Newman does his best outside of the political process, and he's very generous, and he's actually rescued the Nation magazine. So we're all very grateful to him. But why do you think it is that this alleged victory of the Republicans in this last election was allowed to go through with so little protest? I mean, there was a little bit of an outcry, nothing like the more flagrant example, which was the 2000 election results. But is it... what is it about our opposition here that would accept a system where such flagrant manipulation of the electoral process took place, and yet they didn't really go to the wall? They kind of limped off and accepted defeat.
Well, in a word, money. In another word, corruption. In a third word, the media belongs to the big money. It is certainly a chorus for Republican higher politics. They decided to smear anybody who criticized anything to do with them, and particularly to the events in Ohio, which was highly corrupt and in great detail. Congressman Conyers, a Democrat from Michigan, with a group of other congressmen, went out to Michigan, examined all of the polling places, talked to a great many people, got a lot of testimony, and the proof is at hand in a little book, What Went Wrong in Ohio, which is the Conyers Report, to which I wrote a little preface. That was to alert the people to something that everybody sort of suspected it, but nobody did anything. Well, suppose you tried to do something. All right, Congressman Conyers did. He went out there. And he came back with a report that is hair-raising and could put a lot of people in jail for a lot of time. This little book has been out for a few weeks. It has not been reviewed anywhere in the United States. Where's the New York Times, that famous paper of record? New York Times likes big advertisers. It likes big money. It likes to be on the winning side. It likes access to power. God knows what it does with it, but it likes the access and the sense of being powerful just by rubbing up against them. So there has been, if you have a media that is not going to speak out, just about the only place where you can speak out are call-in radio. There is no other place, and unfortunately evangelicals have got hold of a lot of that, but there are still occasionally sane voices who will try to explain what goes wrong, what may go wrong, what's wrong with going into two countries, Afghanistan and Iraq, that have never had the power to do us any harm, nor the will to do us any harm. And we are lied to constantly by media and by the president, the vice president, the entire administration, that they have weapons of mass destruction. They're evil. They're going to destroy us. Why? Because we're good and they're bad. This is a level of baby talk that has now passes for political discourse in the United States. And it is a great shame. And it will be the end of this, because I think the Republic is all over. I don't know how many of people listening in watch C-SPAN, but I was watching a couple of days ago when the Judiciary Committee was meeting and talking about the USA Patriot Act, of which there are many, many things wrong. The Republican chairman of it and the Republican majority of it didn't allow anybody to finish speaking. The chairman, a great fat thing, was up there like a great slug banging away his gavel.
Sensenbrenner, yes. Sensenbrenner.
I never knew how to pronounce it, and thank God you did it for me. It's Sensenbrenner. Well, I'd say senseless Brenner. He is pretty senseless because he's presiding over the death of the republic, the death of the representative system of government. Now, that's all we've got, are the elections for president, when we can change an administration and start over. But we can't change the administration anymore. We continue it. And they had 4 years. I predicted this in 2000. I said, if we let them get away without a fight over the stealing of the election from Albert Gore in favor of George W. Bush, allowing the Supreme Court to select Bush as president, if we allow this to go through without a great deal of protest and a great deal of examination, they've got 4 years to do it again. 4 years later, 2004, they did it again. And since they're rather unoriginal, it's the same scenario. In Florida, it was the woman with all the mascara, Mrs. Harris, who was Secretary of State and in charge of elections. She was the busybody who saw to it that people didn't vote or that all sorts of flawed electoral machinery, both electronic and humanoid, was in place to throw the election the other way. This time, during the 4 years since 2000, they had time to corrupt Ohio. They got themselves a Secretary of State who was in charge of elections there, as they tend to be in most states, and he saw to it that all sorts of extraordinary things happened, making it impossible for people to register to vote. And then, on top of that, as Ms. Harris was the co-chair of the Bush-Cheney ticket, Republican ticket in Florida, 4 years later, the Secretary of State of Ohio is also the chair of the Bush-Cheney. Now, that is major corruption. The head of the elections, who decides who votes and who doesn't vote and what kind of machines they use, that's unheard of. That should be news all over the country. People should march. Instead, everybody's worried about Michael Jackson.
Well, you know, this fellow Blackwell that you're referring to is a zealous born-again. And his offices are in a building that's owned by a wealthy born-again millionaire. And he congratulated the churches for delivering the victory, in quotes, in Ohio, which, of course, resulted in the national victory of the Bush-Cheney ticket. What is your sense, though, Gore Vidal, of this incipient theocracy that we have here in the United States? And is there a countervailing way to blunt it? Because if, as Karl Rove, the architect of Bush's, in quote, victory, last time around he said we lost because we didn't get all of the fundamentalist votes, and there were another 3.5 million fundamentalists who didn't vote, and we're going to get them this time, and apparently they did. So what is the countervailing constituency that, given the level of fraud that you're up against here, you've got to get over that hill? Where do we find, on the left, where do we find the votes?
Well, don't use terms like left and right. I've been around a long time, and I never found any left in the United States.
Well, that's true. I'm just being polite, I guess.
I know. The country is normally divided between conservatives and reactionaries. No, I would say that as long as the media belongs to, I think it's four or five different men, women conglomerates, it's tightly controlled. So we don't get news. People don't get information. And places like Fox News have enormous influence, and they are constantly grinding their axes in favor of, you know, the return of slavery or whatever it is that they would most like to see happen.
Well, they're essentially the Pravda of the Republican Party.
Yes, indeed it is. But, and luckily, just as the Soviet people did, I used to go there occasionally, and I would ask them. They were very well informed, the Russians, and all they had was Pravda, a newspaper that did nothing but tell lies. And I said, how are you so well informed when nobody tells the truth? Oh, they said, you learn how to read Pravda. I said, well, how do you? Well, you have to hold it up to the light, and then you turn it a little to the left, and then a little to the right, and suddenly things start to become clear. So if they say there's been a great harvest in the Ukraine, you know that everybody's starving down there. Well, that's how most of us who care about politics, and more important, care about the Republic, which nobody seems to. You say, what is the countervailing force against the Jesus wants me for a sunbeam set? Well, the countervailing force is the Constitution of the United States. We have made a kind of holy icon out of it, but nobody reads it. And when presented with the Bill of Rights, they used to do this to high school seniors every year. I think they may still do it. Purdue used to do it. They'd ask them questions about, without telling them, they were talking about the Bill of Rights, about all of those rights that we enjoy, like due process of law and freedom of assembly, etc. They asked these 17-year-old high school graduates, what did they think of legislation like this? And a majority turns down the Bill of Rights every year. So that means this starts early. They start at first grade, kindergarten, in order to twist their brains. So authority, money, that's what matters. Authority, obey, obey, obey. And that, by God, that's what people are doing out there. I've never seen. You know, we were once a very volatile, active, energetic, and people who got things done, and we were imitated by the whole world. Now we're sleepwalkers. We're just drifting, drifting, paying no attention, and voting against our own interests, which is fascinating. There is no religious revival going on, by the way. They have managed to get the least educated people in the smallest states. Because that, if you can get those smaller offices, in other words, you don't put up the money for the guy running for president. You get it for the guy running for sheriff or the school board. Richard Viguerie spelled that out back in the 70s.
I saw him on C-SPAN recently laying it all out. He said without overturning the fairness doctrine, we would never have the power and influence we have with talk radio, with Limbaugh, etc. I mean, he laid it out.
Well, and he did it. He was a genius at this sort of thing.
Right.
And he also laid it out very early on. He said, I remember when he decided to really go after the Chigger Belt and get as many of those people in smaller offices. And he said, I'm aware that 90% of the people in the United States disagree with our politics because their politics is reprehensible. Get rid of Social Security. Turn it over to Wall Street. Every man a king. Every man a J.P. Morgan. All this nonsense that they're selling out there. He said they are never going to vote for us because of our ideas and policies. So in order, he didn't say get them to vote against their interests, but that is what he meant. We will seize upon enough people to get us the Electoral College, which is there for the smaller states with smaller populations. And they can then outnumber, due to this 18th century device that our ancestors lumbered us with. And that is how it was done. Certainly that was how it was done in 2000. The Electoral College was moving toward Bush, and the popular vote was certainly moving against Bush and for Gore. Anyway, Viguerie figured it out, and I suppose that the constitutional forces, let us put it like that, and anybody who thinks our Constitution is left-wing never read the slavery clause in it. It is not left-wing, it's not liberal, it is just. Mm-hmm. And it is reflective of 18th century gentlemen who had their prejudices, just like 20th century, 21st century ones do too. It can be done, but it takes hard work and it takes alertness, and vigilance is the eternal price of liberty.
Well, of course, you mentioning the supine nature of our polity here. The reaction to the Deep Throat revealing his existence from not just the Watergate felons who were huffing and puffing, but people like Pat Buchanan and others is extraordinary. What the message of this Republican Party and its power elite, its message is you have to be loyal to power and screw the people and their right to know. It's extraordinary how brazen it is.
They never said they liked the Constitution. They never said that they wanted a greater democracy. They follow the leader in order to make money and to get power for themselves. It's a little game that they play. And the media existed to straighten them out, to keep them under control. And one of the eventually really dumb things that Thomas Jefferson ever said was, in an over-exuberant mood, he said, well, if I had to choose between a nation without a government, this is pre-Constitution, or a nation without newspapers, he'd say, I'd choose a nation without a government. He did not live to see this hour.
Where the ombudsman at the Washington Post, the ombudsman at the New York Times, and the ombudsman at National Public Radio have all come out and criticized their own publications for their failure to report on the Downing Street memo. It's an extraordinary thing. But why do you think, Gore Vidal, that we have such chicken, I can't use the rest of the word, polity here and a lack of courage, lack of real debate? For example, in England, the standard question to a politician is, you said X this week, you said Y last week. Were you lying last week or are you lying this week? You watch the McNeil Lair show, and it's all this, I respectfully disagree with my learned colleague, this so-called compromise that the 14 senators made to avoid the end of the filibuster in a real showdown where I think these crazy right-wingers would have tipped their hand, that was avoided by this same kind of this phony politesse that infects our politics. How did we, in the land of the free and the home of the brave, end up with such constipated politics?
Well, it starts with a very bad public educational system. It was not for nothing that Purdue, I think that was the university, asked all those questions of high school graduates. They're trying to see what it was they had learned about the Republic after 8 years of being in high school and preschool before that, public schools. And the questions were, had anything got through to them about the nature of the Republic? And nothing had. They were all on the side of power, that the police have the right to beat up anybody and you don't have the right to tell lies to them or defend yourself in any way. I think when you have no educational system for the general public, that's very dangerous because you don't have an informed citizenry. They don't know how to vote for their own interests. They just believe, well, Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden together blew up Washington and New York. Well, they hated each other, Saddam and Osama. Saddam had nothing to do with it, so we're holding a man. Yes, he's a bad man, and every time I think about how wicked he is to his own people, I think we've got to get busy. Well, there are a lot of other bad leaders in the world, and we might start at home. But meanwhile, they have been so, I mean, remember that this is a country that for 50 years now has been based on advertising. And though we have perfected no arts in my lifetime, we have certainly perfected the art of getting people to buy things they don't need. And to buy things that are built-in obsolescence and will fall apart in no time at all. Or indeed, if it comes to medicine that will poison you. We're in the business of selling stuff. Well, once you do nothing but that, and the whole country knows that, I mean, people are very wise about their own interests. They don't believe the advertising, but when there is so much of it, as there particularly is with a presidential candidate, I mean, the amount of lies that the Republican administration managed to tell, along with, to be fair, the amount of confusion that Senator Kerry got all about him, like that ink that comes out of squids, you know. Well, if I had it to do over again, even knowing that there were not weapons of mass destruction, I'd still be for the war, at which he should have been shown the exit. then stop running as a Democrat. Stop running against Mr. Bush. After all, he's a bigger liar than you are.
Right. And the one issue upon which Bush was actually vulnerable was the war, and it still persists today. Why they kept that off the table in the election was just breathtaking.
Well, they'd been intimidated naturally, and they are cowardly naturally. The entire media will gang up on them as, you're against our brave boys. I had to go through that all through the Indochina War, the Vietnam War. I used to go on television regularly because the opposition was listened to in those days, and I would often argue with representatives of President Johnson, who was gung-ho about the war, Nixon. And I would say, why are we fighting there? Oh, we're fighting there to contain China. That was the first argument. I said, well, if you want to contain China, don't attack the Viet Cong. What do you mean? Are you a communist? I said, no, but I happen to know that the Viet Cong, the North Vietnamese, have been the enemies of China for 1,000 years. And if you want to contain China, you help them. You don't blow them up. They changed the subject immediately because they don't know any history either. One interesting detail, when I was a kid in school, grade school, my favorite subject was geography. I like finding out about different countries. 1950, when the global empire is in place and Harry Truman has created the national security state, which has turned us into a military juggernaut since all the money goes for war, suddenly, as if by magic, I do not dare say it was a conspiracy, but suddenly, as if by magic, they stopped teaching geography in the grade schools. Now, isn't that a funny thing? Here we are, a global empire, and nobody knows where anything is, starting with the president. The briefings he must have gone through to try and tell him where Iraq was. He knew he had to blow it up, but because we had to stand strong, stand tall. So he wanted to show off. He wanted to frighten other people. What is not discussed is what I'm just about to say. We have deliberately embarked upon an imperial course of world conquest. That's what this game is about, and we're not going to see any cessation. Plans are afoot for invasions of contingency plans, at least for Iran, North Korea, Syria. We're on the march. Have we been consulted, the American people? Were we consulted about Iraq in the year 2000? That we'd be voting for preemptive war against Afghanistan and Iraq? No, we were not asked. Nobody mentioned it to us. Did Gore bring it up? No, I don't think he even dreamed of it. Or if he did, he kept quiet. Well, this is our situation. And unless you know your situation, how do you do anything about it? Now, it's pretty clear what's happening, but media won't talk about it.
What you're saying, Gore Vidal, is that Mao Zedong once, one of his dictums was, the trick is to have hegemony without responsibility. And it seems that given the imperial ambitions that you're talking about, it's not working. I mean, this situation in Iraq is blowing up in our faces. I think that there's evidence now that the Chinese are making separate oil deals with the Saudis, that the United States is hegemonic presence in the Gulf is turning into a millstone, not just around our necks, but around the Sheikh's necks as well. So,
somebody asked Napoleon Bonaparte when he was busy conquering all of Europe, well, what about Asia, Emperor, and what about China? And Bonaparte said, China is a sleeping giant, and I shall let China sleep.
Well, where's Napoleon when you need him? Let me ask you, though, again, a kind of a broader question about why it is in this country compared to this more successful economies of Europe in terms of the distribution of wealth, Australia and other countries. People in the rest of the democracies vote for politicians who actually do something for them. They deliver public services. They pay their taxes. They get their services. Why is it in our politics that people don't expect anything back and that they vote for extraneous things like prayer in school and abortion and other issues that should be relegated to the pulpit, not to the parliament?
Well, I think the answer there was sort of codified by Harry Truman, who started the national security state. And he was warned if he wanted to raise all this money to fight communism, to get bipartisan support, Senator Vandenberg, a Republican, said, well, if you want to have this military buildup and the world was at peace, this is 1945 to 1950, I mean, we were on top of the world and nobody endangered us. But Vandenberg said, if you want this military buildup when there is no enemy in sight, unless you think in 100 years the Soviet Union might be dangerous, you've got to scare the American people to death. So we've had nothing but being frightened to death. Now we're being frightened by terror. Nobody has, you know, it's an abstract noun. Nobody knows what it is, who it is. We certainly know it when we get hit by it, but then we have to sit down and think, why did we get hit? What had we done that led up to being hit? So I would say it was interesting during the last election. I think CNN showed some inaugural addresses. And there was Franklin Roosevelt, our Augustus, our great president. He said, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. He starts off with that, just saying, don't let them frighten you into wars. Don't let them frighten you into handing over all of your savings so that you can give it not to Social Security, but to a banker on Wall Street. Then comes Harry Truman, his successor. We're in a world today in which communism is on the march, and we must stand tall because they are everywhere. And suddenly the difference between two presidents, and it's been the official line of the presidents ever since, is to frighten us with terrible, terrible enemies. That's how we have got such a polity that prefers to talk about, don't burn the flag, in God we trust, all sorts of slogans, and not do anything about containing the military, which is hemorrhaging us of money.
In fact, we're spending more today than we were in the Cold War. And
it's a lot hotter too.
Well, yes, it's ironically the nuclear standoff throughout the Cold War. Of course, I find it really pernicious that Bush and Cheney always talk about how we've never had any fear quite as much as Al Qaeda. You know, a few guys living in caves compared to what we survived throughout the Cold War. Every American city targeted by nuclear weapons on a hair trigger. With on the Soviet side, these geriatrics with their fingers on the button. And the fact of the matter is that was a far more dangerous situation than anything we face today. Although, as you point out, it's far more likely that a nuclear weapon will go off now than clearly there hasn't been a nuclear shot fired in anger since Nagasaki. But do you have any thoughts about how citizens can take back their media?
Well, blogging is very effective. I, unfortunately, am a computer illiterate, so I don't know how to use it. There are about a dozen or two Gore Vidal sites, and I have nothing to do with any of them. I don't even know how to find them. There is one that says, you know, quotes supposedly funny things I've said. I don't know who invents them. Some of them aren't very funny. But there was one I liked in out of London. Somebody says to me, have a nice day now. I'm supposed to have said, sorry, I have other plans.
That's very un-LA. Why was it, do you think, Gore Vidal, that Bush was able to, not that he won the first election, but it was so interesting, the contrast between a cerebral Al Gore, who every time you saw a photo op of him, he looked like Rodin's The Thinker hunched over a laptop, compared to this kind of folksy faux populism that Bush represents. Is basically anti-intellectualism alive and well in the country?
Well, it always has been. I mean, people have always, you know, Abraham Lincoln was a brilliant railroad lawyer, and he pretended to be a folksy man of the people and so on. Well, he was a man of the people in a great sense, but he was very intelligent and
But he was also a great stand-up comic. And he just kept the audiences entertained. I mean, he was the Lenny Bruce of his time. And even if Lincoln had to pretend to be dumber than he was, I mean, we are in trouble. But that's a style. I covered the first election in England for the BBC, the one that brought Blair and New Labour to power. And I watched Blair's tricks, which were not unlike some of our American politicians even then. And any time he got from the parliamentary journalist a hard question, this is when he was teeing off his campaign. And if he got a hard question, he would flash this smile, and he'd say in a very soft voice, "Trust me." So I held up my hand. I was going to say, in the United States, if a politician ever said that to us, we'd be reaching for our wallets to secure it.
It's what Hollywood agents say to you, right?
No, even they are too sophisticated to know that we'll fall for it.
Right. Speaking of Tony Blair, this week, last week when he was at the White House in the joint press conference, where finally the question was asked about the Downing Street memo, of course there was a $1,000 bonus there for the first reporter to ask the question, and the Reuters reporter didn't know about it and has refused to take the money. But nevertheless, the thing that was so palpable about that press conference, Gore Vidal, was the pain of humiliation on Tony Blair's face. Here he was coming over here with his pet project to give money to Africa, and Bush just stiffed him. Bush could care less about Africa. I mean, if he doesn't care about the American people, why would you expect him to care about the African people?
You don't also have to tell him where it was. He didn't study geography either. No, they sort of deserve each other. And yes, it is sad that we have come to this, but the interesting thing is that disaster has often saved the United States. It was Bismarck who said, "The good Lord protects drunks, little children, and the United States of America." Well, I think that the good Lord protects us in the long run by visiting us with a plague of locusts every now and then. And I think that what will save us from this imperial madness, because we're going to be crashing into a wall any minute, we're going to be broke. There's no money left. And nobody seems to know how to add. There are a few tight-lipped old Republican bankers, you know, from the crossroads towns of the Republic, who do understand finance. And they are terrified. Imagine calling Franklin Roosevelt a big spender. He never spent anything like this, including World War II, the amount of money that's out there. We spend a fortune knocking down all the cities in Afghanistan and Iraq. We knock them down. Mr. Rumsfeld knocks them down for us with our money. Then, with the Vice President Cheney's company, Halliburton, gets all this money to build them up again. So, now, if you hadn't knocked them down in the first place, it wouldn't cost so much either to knock them down or build them up. This is not good economics. Now, I say this, you know, not as another John Maynard Keynes, but it doesn't sound right. So we may be saved by that good Lord of Chancellor Bismarck. We'll go broke before we can do any more mischief in the world.
But it's conceivable, Gore Vidal, that you talk about the old style Republicans, the Chamber of Commerce types that used to run the party, and now this four or five senators represent the so-called moderates. The party has clearly been taken over by the Christian jihadis. And the problem with the Christian jihadis who run the Republican Party and who are dictating so much of our life and you know, what we can say, for example, on this radio program is terribly constrained by these people. They don't care about what happens in this life. They only care about where you go in the afterlife. And it's always troubled me, and again, I get back to the feckless press, that somebody in the press has never asked Bush whether or not he shares the core belief system of his core supporters, who have an unhealthy investment in the end of the planet. And it's worth noting that the biggest bestseller in this country are the End of Times series by this fellow LaHaye, who founded the Christian Coalition with Jerry Falwell. 60 million copies have been sold, and exactly 60 million votes went to Bush. So well, is it possible that the 60 million who have an investment in the end of the world are also the people who voted for Bush? And
If I were one of the 60 million, I'd stay home and let the world end all by itself. Why get involved in an election? Ronald Reagan was out in the open about it. He said openly, I believe we have come to the end time, which is what they call Armageddon and the return of the Messiah and so forth. He seems to have really believed in it and often discussed it during his presidency. On the other hand, he did not act upon it. Had he really been sincere about ending time, he wouldn't have made the peace deal with Gorbachev in Iceland.
Right. Well, that's the conflict of interest that I'm referring to, that Bush has. You cannot have an investment in the end of the world and have your finger on the nuclear button. I mean, little wonder he doesn't care about the environment. You know, that's going to burn in, along with all of us sinners, while the righteous hover above us in the rapture. And I believe that even though the Christian right has made a deal with the right-wingers in Israel, I believe only about 140,000 Jews are saved at the last minute. So it's not a particularly good deal for the Israelis.
No, they're supposed to convert, too. So they will cease to be Jews if they survive.
I see.
And I think the thought is hardly any of them will survive the coming turmoil, apocalypse. But I don't think, you know, the way we're going now, I don't think anybody's going to survive, because once little North Korea is sitting there able to aim its missiles at Seattle, we will goad them into doing something very, very rash. Then we will hit them back, and they'll hit us again. Then China will come in. There are more Chinese than there are us, and they are far smarter per capita people than we are. Look at the speed with which they've taken over outsourcing.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to hand also at least the silver prize to the people of India. They're also very bright at taking over our jobs. And if you can stand their accents on the telephone when you try to get long distance, and this is New Delhi,
right.
New Delhi speaking.
Right. You're ordering a pizza and somebody in Bombay is taking your order. It's pretty extraordinary.
Someday you get Bombay duck back.
But the Chinese, though, are buying our debt. They're actually subsidizing our lack of savings and maintaining this sort of fictional standard of living we had, which we have in this country, which is largely predicated on credit card debt. So it seems to me that perhaps that's where the bubble's going to burst.
Well, it's apt to, because they have a nice sense of humor, the Chinese. They've got the yuan, which is a currency that they can manipulate with the greatest of ease. They can buy up all of our treasuries and so devalue their own currencies that our treasuries are floated away. Nobody will then buy them, because they will have lost their initial value. And their face value will be more than we can service. So
I don't believe they're charitable. I don't believe that that's their motive.
I don't think when you have that many people, you can afford charity.
Well, Govind Alais, thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Govind Alais, who is a great American novelist and historian. I thank Louis Vandenberg for the research and producing this program. I thank the engineer, Mark Maxwell. This program can be heard on ianmasters.org, on the net, ianmasters, one word, .org. Bye for now.